Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Weed Wonks, the podcast that dives deep into the nerdy details, the minutia, the ever-fun silliness that is cannabis regulatory policy. And we do it all to help our fellow policy wonks, policymakers, regulators, business members, advocates, and the canna curious stay more informed about the ever-changing landscape of cannabis laws and regulations. Please remember to rate, subscribe, and review. I'm your host, Jordan Wellington, Managing Partner at VS Strategies. As always, we want to give thanks to our sponsors at RootWorks and our amazing producer, Josh, who always does a wonderful job making things sound fantastic. We have a super cool show today, one that I'm very excited about, one that I've been kind of planning for a while now, ever since I met this guy several years ago now, working on some really technical cannabis policy. Based on the last show, you guys should know we are working on kind of a little mini series on testing policy, kind of doing a little stops across the country on different aspects of cannabis testing policy, because it really is one of the more interesting and unique aspects of cannabis policy. As far as I know, we are the only industry in the entire world that has government mandated third party testing requirements where the statutes and regulations dictate the contaminants and levels at which people should be testing for everything. The rest of the world uses CGMP and we do it quite differently. And so I think there's a lot to learn and a lot to grow on here. And so to do that, we have one of my favorite people to talk about testing policy and cannabis policy writ large with, Stephen Goldman, who is the chief scientific officer at Kycha Labs and is an amazing resource and expert on cannabis testing. Welcome to the show, Stephen.
Thank you, Jordan. What a mouthful. You must have done this 90 times already to get that out so quickly.
Once or twice now. I think actually your show 81. So 81. Getting close to 90, big 100 coming up later this year. So Stephen and I have been working together, I think probably about 3-4 years now, I would say, on various cannabis testing policy issues in Colorado. But we get together from time to time and we don't really limit our conversations to Colorado. It's really about what lessons learned, because as we talked in the pre-show, you're one of the few people in the world that has access to kind of like cross-market cannabis testing data in a way that most regulators and even many business owners don't have. You probably look at more cannabis testing data than maybe there's half a dozen to a dozen people on the planet that have this unique ability that work at multi-state labs. So before we get into your background, just frame that a little bit for us. Talk a little bit about Kycha Labs and your role there and why it makes what you can share with us so unique. And then let's go in the Wayback Machine and talk about how you got there how you got there before we get into all the fun testing data stuff.
Yeah, sounds good. Kycha Labs is a testing facility for cannabis and hemp products. We have labs in 7 states right now. A lot of our growth markets are on the East Coast. Currently in Arizona, Nevada, Colorado, New York, Massachusetts, North Carolina, and Florida. All of those laboratories share the same software package. So we have the same laboratory information management system. LIMS system is the acronym that you probably know. The reason why I bring that up is because every test that we run has multiple analytes that we test for, right? In some cases, heavy metals, in some states are 4. In some of our states, the pesticide analysis, which we can come back to, has 106 analytes, right, for every single test. And all of that data is fed into our laboratory information management system. So quite literally, we have millions of data points, all of them correlated by strain names or how a concentrate is manufactured, right, butane, propane, ethanol, all the way to finished products, right, gummies. So I can very, very quickly pull not only pass-fail rates, but chemotype data by strain name in 7 different markets and, know whether indoor or outdoor gives you better terpenes, right? Because we have such a better, more robust data set that's easy to query, I can start having fun with it, right? Which is the whole point of putting a data set like that together. So, a lot of my day is talking to customers in those markets, figuring out what's working, what's not working with policy and the rules and regulations there. But the other half is, querying our data set to make our customers better at what they do, right? If I use ethanol, what's my risk for a particular mycotoxin? Does that risk decrease if I use mixtures of propane and butane? And we do get queries like that, you know, all the time, right? What do I do to eliminate this particular contaminant? And what can you tell me about what's worked? And so it's a super powerful data set, you know, whether you're kind of interested in quality metrics or some of the contaminant metrics, we're able to pull it all. So pretty exciting that we're at the point where we can start to have some fun with it.
Yeah. And I think it's really a very unique lens, right? If you talk to most businesses, even multi-state operators, they're looking at their own test results. So they might be cross-state, but they're one business and one business's way of doing things, which may modify somewhat from state to state. But at the end of the day, it's kind of one narrow lens. Regulators get to look at every testing data, get all the testing data from all their licensees, but it's just one state, right? So they get cross-business, not cross-state. Most labs are single state operators. There are only a handful of multi-state labs. And that gives your kind of bird's eye view a level of uniqueness that I think is pretty awesome. And I know that, you know, one of the ways, as you mentioned, that you leverage that at Kaija is consulting with your clients and kind of helping them solve problems. You're not just there to, you know, give them pass fail grades, but actually be problem solvers, which is a much more traditional lab relationship with their clients anyway. And I think probably the fun part. Of what you get to do. And so I think that that's probably part of it is like one of the things in the story I'll share, and then let's get into your background a little bit. But like we pulled a group together to talk about Aspergillus testing. I'd say like a couple of months ago, just, you know, there's just so many different perspectives and people complaining and people saying this and people saying that and all these kinds of things. And Stephen was kind enough to join this group call that we had put together kind of offline, varying people of different backgrounds in the industry to kind of just learn and share. And after the call, you had said to me, I'm like, I'm really sorry. I hope I didn't like blow up your call and ruin your entire plan. And my response was, no, man, you were like just shooting straight. You know, like I see all this stuff. Here's my perspective. And that's one of the things I've always appreciated about getting to work with you is that you're not, you know, you don't necessarily come to these with like, you know, with necessarily like self-interest or kind of very specific goals in mind. You want to identify solutions and be solution oriented. And you can be very frank in a world in politics where a lot of people, you know, kind of are very careful about how they say things and what they do. And it's not that you're not inarticulate or thoughtful, but just you're willing to be more honest than I think sometimes folks are. And so my guess is your background informs the way you handle those things. And maybe that'll give us that kind of nice story to kind of get there. So, my guess is you've not always been the chief scientific officer at Kaija Labs, and you had a life both before that role and then even potentially before marijuana. So give us a sense of where the story starts in your professional career and your background as you've amalgamated all of this expertise.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I grew up in the Midwest in Iowa, and my undergraduate degree was in chemical and biochemical engineering. And if you are a chemical engineer in Iowa, what you end up doing a lot of is agriculture. And, you know, it's a little bit funny looking back now, given that I'm in agriculture, right, in the cannabis industry. But at that time, I said, I don't want to be a chemical engineer in agriculture. So I moved to Kansas and entered a pharmaceutical chemistry graduate program. With the intention of, you know, really entering the pharmaceutical industry and helping to develop drugs. And I did do that for a short time. It took me to California and also brought me to Colorado. And, you know, I was able to experience kind of the good and the bad of the pharmaceutical and the biotech industry. You know, the first example would be in the biotech industry, right? I was working on really cool technologies that are still kind of cutting edge today, something called antibody drug conjugates. So ADCs, right? So you take an antibody, which is really specific for binding a particular place in your body, and you connect it to a small molecule that's super toxic, right? Think like anti-cancer drug, right? But the anti-cancer drug is also bad because it kills healthy cells. It kills the cancer cells really well, but it also kills the healthy cells. So you can't really, you know, give it in high concentrations in people. But you tie it to, or you connect it to this antibody that's really good at drug delivery, And now this super toxic small molecule goes exactly where you want it to go because of the antibody. The antibody gets cleaved and it delivers the payload, right? The antibody drug conjugates are super cool. There's a lot of breast cancer ones that have, you know, been life-changing, right? Like the worst kind of breast cancer is now, you know, in quotes, the best kind to get because the medicines, you know, are so good at dealing with it. That's because of these antibodies and these antibody drug conjugates. So super exciting work, extremely well-funded, you know, industries. But my portion was the itty little portion, right? I worked on the chemistry of the linker, not the antibody, not the super toxic small molecule, but the linker that held the two together.
And you were the glue guy.
I was the glue of the cog, right? And the little widget that I produced was, you know, I was one of 100 people that were working on the linker, right? So, you know, that's the bad side, right? The impacts that you have to public health are really minimized. Although, you know, sum everybody's contributions up and it's really impactful work. So kind of similar thing in Colorado where I was working in a QC lab, a testing laboratory, supporting the manufacturing of a plant that made generic drugs. Again, for the pharmaceutical industry. That's what brought me to Colorado. So the same exact kind of testing laboratory, that same equipment even that we're running in cannabis today, but supporting the manufacture of a plant, right? So this is where you see, you know, GMP, FDA oversight, you know, the pharmaceutical company that's developing these pills, these generic pills, is also the one that employed me and employed the lab, right, to test the product. So already super different than cannabis. And they're making millions of pills at a time, right? In these uber clean rooms, you know, with over the top, exactly what you're thinking of, right? Like scrubs and independent HVAC and, you know, a hair is in there and there's an SOP on how to deal with, you know, doing that hair. But the testing at that laboratory supported, you know, millions of generic drugs going out. So again, super well funded, but you make, and this is not a made up story. You make $9 billion on a drug and maybe you get a $2 billion fine for bribing doctors in China. Pretty, you know, plus $7 billion is still a pretty good business model, right? Mm-hmm. As long as you're all right with the bribing doctor part, right? And you know, that's kind of the last experience that I had in the pharmaceutical industry and directly joined a very small cannabis testing lab in Denver, Colorado, that was just starting out in 2015, right, when the recreational or retail side of cannabis got started. And that laboratory kind of grew from 2015 until today, right? Back then, the only, as you well know, the only type of testing that was required was potency testing. And then Colorado, and I think this is the only state that's ever done it. None of the other states that we're currently in have done this, where they phase in the testing. You know, year zero potency testing was required. Year one potency testing and now residual solvent testing is required. Year three, then micro, the rollout, right? So the lab grew from, you know, a tiny lab that was offering one test for a very small number of clients to two tests for more clients and three tests and four tests and eventually you know, we got where we are today, right? All other states just, they flip the switch, right? On day one, you must test for all of these tests, but not Colorado. So it was a super interesting experience in not only, you know, the rollout, but because your revenue streams were so non-diverse, you had to get really good at supporting your clients in other ways, right? How do you really eliminate this problem? And then move on to the next one. So kind of an interesting.
And Colorado did that because they were first, right? Yeah. Like it's a lot easier in 2024 to be like, oh, we're just going to start now and say test for everything. In 2013, nobody had any answers to even what that looked like, right? So when we're doing implementation in 2013, we established a testing program and that testing program included all the contaminants that you said that rolled out. It wasn't, the rules included them, but then what the division did, which, you know, smart or not, doesn't really matter. It's what they did is they said, okay, here's the full list of stuff we're going to require, but we're not going to require the full list on day one. we're going to get test version one dialed in. Then we're going to move on and open up the second one and the third one. And I think that, you know, what we've seen is, you know, obviously it made it tricky to run a business, but at the same time, I think Colorado has had a successful rollout of its testing program kind of by staging things to some extent. Like, I think there was some logic and reason behind the decision. And I think that if they had tried to roll out every form of contaminant testing and everything else, like day one of the market in 2014, I think it would have been a mess. The labs weren't ready for it for the most part. The one you worked at was maybe, we'll say, unique among the labs in Colorado in its sophistication in some ways. And so, you know, we have this kind of omnipresent reality of like, there's the ideal way we would like to do things. And then there is, we need to go with baby steps in cannabis because you can't go from, you know, 0 to 60 overnight on what you're requiring from a testing program. In fact, cannabis wasn't even required to be tested in the medical program in Colorado. The idea of a mandatory testing program was considered to be ridiculous. Nobody was thinking that that was going to come in. And then way back in the day, Can Labs, which isn't even around anymore, they're the ones who came to the Capitol and started saying, hey, wait a minute, we need to do stuff around testing. And they're the ones that got the original testing permissions and authorizations put into law. And then we had to kind of figure it out. That was one of my great lessons of kicking the can to myself, is what exactly are we going to test for and how much and when? I don't know. We'll figure it out in rulemaking. That'll be someone else's problem, until I got hired by the regulatory agency and they said it was my job to figure out the thing I thought I was punting to someone else. So you never know what the future holds. But I think that that's an important part to get back to your story. Like, you started out at the ground floor of cannabis testing and did it in this way where you weren't, again, just send us the sample, we'll give you results. You knew from day one that there was a symbiotic relationship between labs and clients as problem solvers, not just answer givers. We're not here to just give you a COA and tell you a number. We're here to sit here and say, okay, here's how we solve this problem together. And I think that that's a really important component. So you've basically been working in cannabis testing for almost a decade now.
Yeah, which makes me a grandpa, right, in cannabis testing. But, you know, a lot of the rollout is selfish, right? Because there weren't any reference methods. Nobody knew the best way to test for cannabis. Maybe nobody, you could argue, maybe nobody knows today still the best way to test cannabis, right? But especially
pretty reasonable given what's going on. I mean, the last show we dove, just for reference so you understand it, because it hasn't even released yet, and I don't know that you listen to everything we put out, but we had a really good conversation about what's going on in Mississippi right now and all the problems in their testing market on the last show. Yeah. So if you want to talk about nobody really knows and there's some wonky stuff going around reference standards, I mean, that is, without over speculating, related to the issues that are going on in Mississippi right now, is kind of this lack of standardization.
Absolutely. And I do want to chat about that when we get there, because that's, you know, willful ignorance is probably a good theme, right, of what you could talk about when you talk about cannabis testing laboratories. But, you know, we had to learn how to do it along the way, right? So not only were we helping our clients figure out, you know, how to drive off butane when they make a shatter. But we were learning, you know, what were the specific matrix interferences, ion enhancements or suppressions on the pesticide assay, right? Because they were able to give us, you know, the matrix to actually run those experiments. And that had never been published before. It had never been done before, right? So because there are no reference methods, you know, that growth curve was super important for us as well.
Yeah. And so I, you know, without getting too much into it, because I want to get into some of the substantive topics, but I think maybe just really quickly, you went from, you know, kind of in more traditional, let's just say traditional laboratory chemistry background kind of person, got into cannabis testing on the ground floor, and are now a C-level executive at a very well-run, strong business that's doing amazing things in cannabis testing across the country. Maybe, you know, a couple words just on that journey and the work that you put in and you know, through the lens of maybe a young person that's listening to this saying, man, how do you, how do I walk that path? Like what did it take from you and how many late nights and kind of interesting stops along the way that it took to build up to this incredible career that you've had?
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, a lot of long nights, but you know, I was lucky because I had a diverse background, right? A chemical engineer plus the pharmaceutical and the chemistry side. And when you're, you know, when you're getting your education, very rarely do you find scientists who have business acumen, right? Or business people that have, you know, a scientific or technical acumen, right? You gain that with experience, but you don't start there, right? And, you know, a lot of success is, you know, timing or being lucky, right? And here comes along this new industry where there's not a lot of scientific acumen, I would argue, in the early days, right? Hiring new people, you know, in 2015, I had a lot of conversations when I was hiring, well, how's this going to impact my resume, right? If I put cannabis testing lab on it. So there was some hesitation, right, to do that. And same for, you know, folks with strong business acumen, right? I don't think, and it's probably still true, I don't think there are a lot of lab directors of cannabis testing labs that calculate KPIs or know the margins of their tests even today, right? Which is a little bit shocking, maybe a little bit not shocking, right? So it's important to keep both of those things in mind. And I don't think many people frame their day-to-day job that way. At least the number of people that I've seen, and I've probably interviewed over 100 lab directors at you know, our competitors and people from different industries that want to enter the cannabis space. So, you know, it takes a lot of ripping the Band-Aid off and figuring out where your deficit is and how to make that deficit a strength, right? And, you know, if you're a scientist, you know, jump into the MBA world, right? You don't even really need that MBA, but, you know, learning strong fundamentals is important, right? How many cannabis companies didn't learn about cash flow from 2016 to 2024? A lot of them.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that that's, I you know, I think one of the lessons that we can draw from this is, you know, a lot of us come to cannabis with a very a particular and specific skill set, right? Like my background was in public policy, legislative drafting, but over the years, my deficit, I mean, I had a decent head on my shoulders and kind of ran some version of a quasi small business, but my growth had to be on that business acumen side. And I think that that's maybe one of the really important lessons. If you want to grow and be successful in your career, when you're a technical expert of any kind and you want to work in the private sector, at the end of the day, it's all about, it's, you know, it's a business. And, you know, I frequently joke around at work, like all of the amazing things that we've built from our company culture to our benefits plans to the team that we've hired and the young people we've mentored, well, it boils down to a math problem at the end of the day. Like you get this much money, you spend that much money. And if that problem doesn't balance, all the good stuff you build on top of it ain't worth a hill of beans. And you got to make sure you're able to kind of balance that math problem. And if you don't build up that dual acumen, you know, you're there. And it's, you know, it's funny. You were worried about your resume. And I, same thing when they were like, hey man, you're going to be in charge of implementing marijuana legalization. Go do all the policy work. Go meet Dan Pabon. He's awesome. Follow Dan around and he'll help you. And do what Dan needs done to get this bill to the other side. Many, many, many moons ago when I first met at the time Majority Leader Dan Pabon, I was scared shitless. I was like, dear God, like, am I going to get a job after this? And 11 years later, I have an amazing job that I love. But it's scary, that first little bit. Is this going to work? Like Senator Uliberry, who is a great Colorado senator, really an amazing visionary. At one point, I was like walking out of Steuben's when he was walking in and he was like, Jordan, you're the pot guy. And I'm like, dude, please don't call me that. I got to get a fucking job. Like I have like a wife. I'd like to have a family. I've got like 200 grand in law school debt. And he's like, dude, you don't even realize like what you've done yet. And like what the rest of your life is going to like, he saw it and I didn't. So, you know, I think you take some of these leaps of faith. And then I think the other thing is, as you noted, like you got to keep working on your skills. You don't just show up and rest on your laurels. you grow your experts and your technical skills, and then you add the supplementary ones that you need to help bring this in. And so that duality of your background in terms of coming in with non-cannabis experience and cannabis experience, I think leads us to our next topic and the first real substantive topic we want to get into today, which is what you are currently testing for in every state is driven by the government, right? They say, these are the analytes that you're looking for. You're going to test for these specific things. You're going to test them at this specific time in the production supply chain. You're going to test for this in this way. You're going to test this frequency. And if it's at this level, above or below, that's pass or fail. The rest of the fucking planet doesn't work that way, right? Mm-hmm. The rest of the planet is completely different. And I'd like to really get into the illustration of what those differences mean, because in cannabis, we have a lot of tests, but they're all for the same thing at the same point in the supply chain in every state. How would that be different in the non-cannabis world, in the really real world?
Yeah. And it's, you know, I'll frame that question with one of risk, right? Because that's how the real world does it. And so
yeah, everything in business is just risk analysis.
Right, exactly.
It's all noise. Everything else is just, I'm analyzing my risk and I'm making a decision based upon the risk and benefit and then guessing what the course of action should be.
Right. So let's say that we are a pharmaceutical company, company A, and we make a drug and that drug needs to get approval. And it's a super expensive process to make a drug and to get an approval process, right? So I need to make that drug as fast as possible and minimize all the chances that I could mess up. So, you know, to make that drug, I need to buy a lot of raw materials, all the ingredients to that drug. And because I don't have control of those raw materials and ingredients, when I buy them, I test them to make sure that I'm not bringing in something terrible into my facility, right? Because if I do that, I've already lost the game, right? So that's the first difference. Raw materials coming into my facility are tested.
Okay, and let's just pause there because I think there's a really important point of clarification. When you say raw materials, you do not just mean the cannabis, I'm a manufacturer, the cannabis flower that I bought from person X.
No, you mean
if I'm a cultivator, am I testing the soil that I'm buying from my soil provider?
Nutrient mixes.
All of the inputs. Am I testing all of the inputs into my process
as
they're coming into the facility?
Right. And we've tested a lot of soil and water and nutrient mixes across all our labs at Kaicha Labs. And guess when we test it? Not before someone uses it, but when someone says, oh man, there's a contaminant in my product. Can you figure out where it's coming from? I failed the test. So well after the problem has already presented itself.
And I think that's a really good way to think about the framing here, because that's what drives all of this, right? In the cannabis world, we have end of product, like final product point before transfer testing, right? And what we're trying to do is figure out at that last moment, is this safe or not? And then if it isn't safe, we're going to go back and solve the problem. We are testing to figure out if there was a problem, and then we're going to go solve it or destroy it or deal with it.
Right.
In the really real world, which is what we're going to keep calling non-cannabis, because I think it's funny. If anyone gets the movie reference, you can let me know. Most people won't. But in the really real world, they are testing in a more preventative way, right?
Absolutely.
They're trying to do that testing up front in the process to identify and avoid a problem. Not, I'm testing to ensure I didn't create one. I am testing up front to make sure I don't have one on the back end. The difference between proactivity and reactivity drives really the core of all of these differences, right? That underlying philosophy of what we're doing here drives so much of these differences. And I think that's an important one to highlight. You're testing those things reactively, not proactively.
Absolutely. And it's customized for my manufacturing process or cultivation process, right? If I take all these ingredients and I stir them together and then I filter them, and the thing that I stirred them with or the filter that I filtered them with is made of metal, maybe I should look for little metal shavings or elemental impurities after I do that, right? Like I'm not introducing a pesticide when I stir them. Maybe it makes sense to not test it for pesticides after I stir them and mix them all together, right? What I'm actually looking for is based on the risk of what I'm doing. And, you know, that doesn't exist at all, right, in cannabis. You know, maybe you could argue a little bit on the solvent, on the residual solvent side of testing, but none of the other contaminant tests do that, right?
And no, they're not driven. They're driven by a theoretical upfront risk-based analysis at the regulatory level. Theoretically, these are the risks that we would expect to see in cannabis cultivation or cannabis manufacturing writ large, regardless of how anyone's doing anything. Mm-hmm. Again, contrasting the really real world where you do a formal and exhaustive risk analysis and then test in accordance with the identified risks. Right. You talked about testing precursors. The other thing you were alluding to is testing throughout the process. Correct. Again, very different. Cannabis endpoint testing, not I'm going to test after step A, after step B, after step B, after step C, D, E. Now, maybe there's a good pause to say, in many cases, I think as you kind of alluded to in your description of your background and your experience, a lot of that testing is also done in-house, which makes it more economically feasible.
Absolutely.
So, you know, this isn't the goal here isn't to dog on cannabis businesses for being lazy, because it's not them. They are reacting to the regulatory and economic market in which they find themselves in, and they are testing in accordance with the direction that they've been provided. And all of the money, all of the budget that can be allocated to cannabis testing is being soaked up by compliance with endpoint regulatory testing. And therefore, there is not really revenue and budget left for the more CGMP style throughout the entire thing, because we are testing based on this theoretical risk, macro risk analysis, not, hey, here are my points of risk. I'm going to focus all my resources on my points of risk.
Right, right. And no CFO, right, in the world is going to approve, you know, 1% of your COGS towards testing. We're going to change that to 3% because we really want to screen raw materials and in-process testing. That shift is only going to happen when you can actually eliminate the initial 1%, right?
Well, and your competitors probably aren't. So like it's part of it's your CFO and getting through the budget thing. It's also, if you do that, you better find a way to market it and make sure your customers are willing to pay more for your product because you're doing throughout the process testing because your competitors are only doing endpoint testing. Sure. And so you literally would be putting yourself not only in a complicated budget situation in difficult cannabis times, but also you'd be putting yourself at a competitive disadvantage, whether you think it's the right thing to do or not, because of the structure that we have, this the way the government has put this policy together and out of necessity, right? It wasn't like, I know why this policy was created this way. It was because the Marijuana Enforcement Division needed to create a policy because I created the cannabis testing policy. We needed to find a policy, a testing policy that was not a risk-based analysis because there was nobody at the regulatory agency at the time, and maybe not even today outside of Brandon, that could even understand what that risk-based analysis was. It needed to be this binary pass-fail that the regulatory agency could oversee. They didn't have the help of the people at the Colorado Public Health Department of Public Health and Environment to help them do the thing they normally do in the really real world, because the Public Health Department refused to do the thing they do in the really real world and said, MED, you guys sort it out. And they were like, but we don't know anything about this. So it was created by necessity, not to blame anybody for doing something wrong. The situation necessitated regulators creating this endpoint testing problem. They dealt with the reality of the cards that they were dealt. They move forward that way. And now we're in this situation. And, you know, it's very hard to put the toothpaste back in the tube. So we're here now.
Yep. And the idea of, you know, what you're describing is the idea of perceived risk versus real risk, right? Back then, there was a perceived risk, right, from everyone. Drugs are bad. You know, this was a drug. So we really need to make sure it's good now, not it's bad now. And so they looked in places like, you know, the UN, what are some of the mycotoxins that are present in other crops, in wheat and in corn? And if you look that up, the top five most common mycotoxins are aflatoxins and ochratoxin in other crops. And guess what we test for in cannabis now? And, you know, there's even reports back then, if you may or may not remember this company, BOTEC, B-O-T-E-C. It literally stands for back of the envelope. Literally stands for that. And they put out a cannabis report summarizing what they thought could potentially be issues. And a lot of the cannabis testing regulations come from that. And things like that, right? And so we're trying to measure this perceived risk because we literally have no idea. We have no other options.
Right. And
so Colorado did it that way. They had no other options.
And Colorado, interestingly, didn't start out with mycotoxin testing. We started out with biological contaminant testing, total yeast and mold. We started out with pesticide testing. We tested for a couple of specific speciations of microbiological contamination and residual solvents, right, for concentrates. When the law allowed for the remediation of contaminated flower, so when the industry said, hey, this flower is contaminated with mold, but if I extract it, it will kill all the mold, and then the ensuingly produced concentrate will be completely safe for consumption. Can we do that? Because the only option at that point was to destroy what was significantly valuable crop at businesses that have a lot of economic pressure even at that time. So this is a common practice around the country. This is now allowed to be done. Again, endpoint versus preventative, blah, 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 putting all that aside. But that's the first time I ever heard the word mycotoxin, because I'm not a chemist. My skill set is learning shit really, really quickly and figuring out how to put it into a policy puzzle. So someone's like, well, what about the mycotoxins? And I'm like, what the fuck is a mycotoxin? Like, where is that coming from? We haven't talked about that. And basically what they said was the extraction process will kill the mold, but it could leave behind mycotoxins. And therefore, we need to include mycotoxin testing if we're going to allow you to use product that you knew had mold on it, not product that you weren't sure if it had mold on it. Now you know it has mold. You're going to extract it. You're going to kill the mold. We believe you it's going to kill the mold. Turns out it does kill the mold, but does it leave behind mycotoxins? And nobody knew if it would leave behind the mycotoxins. Nobody knew if the extraction process would destroy them or not. So they said, we've got to add this new contaminant test. And then, as you noted, back of the envelope calculations, which I do remember BOTEC, and I, one of my, that is a classic cannabis industry joke that probably only a handful of insiders really appreciate, but I love it because it's really true. A lot of this stuff came from guesswork, because guesswork was what everybody wanted. It was guesswork was all we had.
Right. And in the meantime, every state copy and pasted Colorado's mycotoxins, right? They copy and pasted the regulations.
Oh, yeah. I mean, every state that comes along basically says the same thing. Colorado did it wrong. We don't want to do it like Colorado. That's like the political argument. We're going to be tighter and better for all these reasons. And then you get through the ballot initiative, you get through the legislative session, you get through the rules, and like the nerdy people who just read the rules like me walk over and they're just like, y'all just dogged on Colorado and then copied and pasted half our rules.
Yep.
And I've gone around the country and I've seen people be like, oh, look at this. You know, we added this. I was like, yeah, man, like I wrote that into Colorado regulations when I worked at the MED 8 years ago. I know what it says. I know where you got it from because it's the exact words verbatim, which isn't a bad thing, right? Like in the really real world, product safety would not be a state by state experience, right? It would be one national best standard. So that's actually a good thing that they're copying and pasting each other. The bad thing is that the source material is guesswork because that's guesswork. We didn't have it.
That's right. And that's why it's so interesting now, right? Because now we have the data to say what is a real risk and not a perceived risk, right? And obviously that has huge policy implications.
I think that we do and we don't. And I want to get to the real risks and what you're seeing from the testing data. But there is one piece that we need to acknowledge, I think, before we get into that. And that is the limitation of the data set that even you are working with. As one who has probably more cannabis testing data at his fingertips than maybe anybody on the planet other or the equivalent of half a dozen people, you are only looking at tests that people are performing. And people are only performing tests of certain analytes at certain points in the supply chain as dictated by regulations. And you have a huge volume of that data. But what we don't know is if people were doing a real risk-based analysis, testing at different points of the supply chain for the analytes that and contaminants that their risk-based analysis said they should be looking for, we don't know the difference in the data. Because I think there's another world or a future world where a future Stephen is looking at a more robust data set because that we're looking for analytes that nobody's talking about right now because the risk-based analysis said we should look for them, or we're looking at them for at different points in the supply chain and different points in the production process, not just at the endpoint. So yes, we have far more data than we have ever had, and I think we can draw a lot of conclusions, but we also have to recognize, you know, as people in the policy space, there is a lot we still don't know, and that even the most robust data sets have limitations because of the structure of the testing program, that if people were doing CGMP, doing a risk-based analysis, you would have maybe like a wider data set. You would have more data points to look at, but you wouldn't have the same number of tests. Like, you have more of the same version of tests now, which is really helpful. But in another world, you'd have less of the same kind, but more different types of tests at different points that could tell us something that we might not know until 10 years from now as things kind of continue to evolve. Right? Can you give us a sense of the scale of that? Like, where's that gap? Like, if you felt like if everyone was going through a CGMP kind of thing, like, how much more testing more different types, different points of the supply chain would people be looking for?
For sure. Like
a doubling, a tripling?
Not even that much. You know, I think, and just to revisit the point about the data set that we do have, right? In many of the states, we don't even do the sampling as the lab, right? The cultivator or the manufacturer takes the sample and then brings it to us, right? So imagine if it's 2015 and you needed to test a potency test to sell your product, and the potency number, you know, relating back to your talk last week about Mississippi, the potency number drove that transaction. What kind of sample are you going to bring me? Are you going to bring me that trim, or are you going to bring me like the most crystalliest, perfect flower that you've ever seen, right? And that's true of all the samples that we get, right? If you need to pass a pesticide test to sell your product, you are much more likely to sample your product in a way that minimizes the chance that I'll see a pesticide. True of every single thing, micro, all the assays that we run, right? And so, of course, the data set is biased on sampling, right? And it's heavily biased on being endpoint testing, because that's all we ever see, right?
Yeah.
In the CGMP world, you know, that about 20% of that shifts to upfront testing, right? Raw materials, ingredients, things like that. About 10% of that becomes environmental testing, right? Things that you would screen for on some sort of preset frequency just so that you could detect when there's a problem, right? I'm going to do air samples. I'm going to, you know, swab the micro. I'm going to, you know, put some touch plates out, right? That's what the meat industry does, right? When they're looking for salmonella or E. coli, usually they catch it, right, through testing. Either environmentally or right when they're done packaging, right? They cut the cow and they take some samples. They don't send it to the grocery store and then send the lab a sample and say, oops, for a lot of reasons. So, you know, I don't think if we shifted fully to like a more CGMP way of testing products, I don't actually think the number of tests changes that much.
Right.
It's just shifted to earlier and earlier in the process.
Because, and I think that's an important point.
If I test early and I test intermediate, I already know how the final test is going to come up. I already know. So those tests are going to go down drastically, right? So I just think it's a shift in when you're spending that money.
Yeah, I think that's a really important thing. I don't want business owners listening to this to think we're talking about or advocating for a significant increase in the total amount of testing. I think what we're suggesting is that in the really real world, the same amount of testing and maybe even less testing could be occurring.
Yeah.
It's just done at different points in the supply chain. It's done it's, as you noted, pre-materials, environmental, after each step in the process. It's not every batch. They're not doing batch. I mean, pharmaceuticals doing batch testing, but not everybody's doing batch testing of everything. They're testing on a kind of like statistically significant sampling basis of things throughout the supply chain. They're testing for maybe more different types of analytes and different things. And then, of course, you noted the bias issue in sampling. And so as we get into the data set and some of the really interesting stuff you're seeing, we just want to upfront, and then we're going to let it go acknowledge there is bias in sampling. There is bias in the timing of the test. There's bias in all of these different things. But hey, this is far better than when we were back of the envelope calculating everything back in the day. We've got a decade of data, maybe not the greatest data in the world. It's got its limitations, but we are exponentially more informed than we were. And I think there's a lot of amazing lessons to learn. So given this background, given this big picture, let's walk through a couple of the different areas of testing and what your experience, what your unique background, visibility, data set, and what are the conclusions you're drawing from it, starting with everyone's always favorite starting place, microbiological and contaminant testing on that front.
Yeah, for sure. That one's fascinating, right? Because we have the food safety kind of tests, right? Salmonella, E. coli. And then we have the screening methods that are kind of, you know, more appropriate for agricultural products, right? Like total yeast and mold or coliform, right? Or aerobic bacteria. And then we have everyone's favorite, Aspergillus. And across all of our states, there's very little harmonization in the answer to this question. Well, how much is bad, right? In Colorado, if we take total yeast and mold, 10,000 colony forming units per gram is bad. But in Florida, 100,000 colony forming units per gram is bad. And in New York, on the recreational side, there is no bad level. So, you know, I can put out a COA that says 2 billion CFUs per gram, and that COA will have a pass on it, right? Because the state of New York says there is no upper limit. It's up to every company to define the risk of what the test result is, right? So,
and I think, but just for New York, I think it's really important to understand the history of that before we just kind of, yes, it's different, but New York started out, I think, at 10,000 CFUs. And then when a lot of their early cultivators, which a lot of them were coming from the hemp space,
were failing because
they'd been growing outdoor hemp, and this wasn't an issue in the outdoor hemp space. It's not, again, no judgment, just was the issue. Instead of saying, okay, well, you guys have to figure out getting below a number, which is what everyone in Colorado, with all the cultivators in Colorado, were told. Hey, they were like, hey, we're having trouble passing this number. And they were like, well, go figure out how to pass it. And they did, and now it's not as big of an issue. In New York, instead of telling everybody to figure it out, the solution was, well, we'll just get rid of that test, basically. You know, honor system, everyone just make sure your shit's safe. And I think that was a political decision and a supply, like having enough supply to get the market off the ground because people wanted to see the market running. That was not a decision that was driven by product safety. And I wasn't in there. I'm not saying that's my guess from the outside. If someone wants to correct me and I was wrong, that's fine. I'd love to learn I was wrong. But from the outside, it felt like that was more politically motivated than we have done an assessment and made a safety determination about mold contamination.
That's right.
But nonetheless, 10,000. So let's put New York aside because I think.
I want to keep them in. And here's the reason, because when you don't worry about passing or failing a test, that sampling bias, the sample that you bring to the lab, you're not worried. You don't do anything to it, right? When you are worried about passing a test in a market that has a low pass-fail threshold, 10,000 or 1,000, whatever it is, you know, maybe there's some different sampling techniques, or maybe there's, you know, some decontamination steps that take place. And so when I look at total yeast and mold, or any kind of plating method, right, a screening method as a biomarker, and I was to plot, for example, the level that I get from total yeast and mold versus the likelihood that I will see something else bad, like Aspergillus, and I look in a state like Colorado, I see, okay, there's really no correlation to when the total yeast and mold goes up. I don't really see a more or less chance of failing for Aspergillus. But if I look in New York and I plot the total yeast and mold numbers versus the likelihood that I see Aspergillus, there's absolutely a correlation. I see higher levels of total yeast and mold definitely lead to a higher chance of seeing Aspergillus in the sample. So what does that tell us?
I mean, the first thing it tells us is people in Colorado have identified solutions for passing tests. A lot of them are using decontamination technology, and that maybe that decontamination technology is that Aspergillus is harder to get rid of than some of the other contaminants. And so when you are treating your product, Aspergillus is still kind of tricky in terms of what you find. But if you have no incentive to treat your product, you have no incentive to really care at all how much mold is on your product, then you have a direct correlation, which would mean that I would assume it means in part, and probably means a lot of things that you'll tell me, but my first guess is it means that the decontamination methods have an easier time getting rid of other types of total yeast and mold than they do in Aspergillus, because people treating their products are still resulting in problems with Aspergillus. Or maybe the Aspergillus contamination is occurring post treatment, right? Because that's also part of the problem is, absolutely, you know, you can decontaminate it and get your total yeast mold and mold count down to zero. And then one of your trimmers doesn't wash their hands after they go to the bathroom. And the next thing you know, you got bacteria covered cannabis, right? Like it's, yep, you know, like it's, it, and it wasn't the fault of the decontamination equipment. It was, you know, a lot of contamination, as I understand it, occurs in the trimmer. That's probably your greatest source of contamination. It's not, some of it is in the growing process, but actually in the trim room is the kind of greatest source of concern.
Absolutely. Yeah. You get it all in the same place and then you mix it up and you throw it into the air, right? Yeah. That's definitely where you see it. But you know, that observation is, you know, interesting for a lot of reasons, right? Like if we use a screening method to predict the likelihood of other bad things in there, is that justification enough to keep screening methods in place in all of the markets, or you know, should we remove them? I hear a lot of things like, you know, 10,000 is not a real level, right? And 100,000 is not a real level. These are made up. And I'm like, yes, but generally, the higher the number, the more likelihood that I'm going to see something bad in there, right? And if you dive down into the species, right? These are plating methods, right? So anything that grows on a plate is going to be counted, right? You see a lot of Penicillium. You see a lot of Aspergillus. You see a lot of things that Candida, maybe yeasts. You see a lot of things that on their surface, right? Is Penicillium bad or good? Could you answer that question?
Could I? No.
Yeah.
No. You know, no. I let you people like you answer that question, normal, and then I figure out how to make it into a law.
Well, the normal immune system can handle Penicillium pretty easily, right? But what Penicillium can do is make mycotoxins, similar to Aspergillus, right? So, yes, some of those microorganisms are less dangerous than others. And certainly a lot of cannabis has a lot of these organisms, right, that could be considered less dangerous. But are they still biomarkers for other bad things? I think the answer would be yes.
Yeah, I think that that's absolutely true. And that's part of this kind of like risk-based analysis that, you know, it isn't happening, but maybe people can argue the total yeast and mold is. And this is the other point that I want to make sure we talk about on TYM testing. And that is the order of magnitude of the level of mold, right? And I think this is something that you can speak to, you know, pretty fairly, is that in states that have a total yeast and mold upper limit of 10,000 CFUs, you see folks failing at a certain order of magnitude, right? So you have a lot of stuff that passes below 10,000. And then when you do, you have stuff failing at 12,000, 20,000, 30, 40, 50. Occasionally you'll get something over 100 or 120, but I don't really hear a lot over that like 125, 150 mark in Colorado in my experience. Right. There may be some, but it's very rare. When you talk about Michigan, the same orders of magnitude apply, but your base number is different. So when people are failing, they're failing at 120, 125,000, 200, 300, half a million, a million and a half. The same order of magnitude that's occurring in Colorado in terms of that distribution of where people are falling is the same. It's just when you're shooting for 10,000, you're failing at the raw number is very different than when you're shooting to get under 100,000. And I think that a lot of the people who have been advocating, and this has been a longstanding debate in Colorado, to increase from 10,000 to 100,000, one of the concerns that I've heard from public health people is, well, hold on a second, between process validation and all kinds of the other problems with the testing system, you know, what happens if we move it up to 100 and something's at 1 million or 2 million? Because like 200,000, you know, is a lot from 10,000, but like 2 million is, people are, all of a sudden you'll talk to folks who are like, wow, we're incredibly concerned about that level. And you're essentially inviting, like, everything's going to happen off of a distribution curve. And so when the middle, when the bell of the the fat middle of the bell distribution curve is supposed to be at 10,000, that's very different in raw numbers when that middle is 100,000. And what do you see in the testing data? Like, am I talking out of my ass here, or is there there's a lot of validity to this?
In fact, that's right on. And when we look state to state and we just compare the overall fail rates for micro tests, and we normalize it, you know, based on the number of tests that each laboratory is running, they're the same. So our Florida lab, if I look at the number of micro fails as a percentage of all their tests, is the same as the Massachusetts lab, and is the same as the Arizona lab, is the same as the Colorado lab. And
so that's fascinating in and of itself, that the argument that if we just increase from 10,000 to 100,000, we would have less failures doesn't appear to hold water.
That's true. And the reason is exactly what you were talking about, right? Because it's a normal distribution of values that you're going to get, and you're just shifting that to more and more numbers.
Yeah. And that's, I think that's significant. Like, I don't, you know, I don't know if there's much else to say, because I think we've kind of said it, but that is a very significant data point when you're looking at making public policy determinations, because the argument of, first of all, the argument right now, the business owners are saying, hey, if we up this number, I'm going to fail less. And I think the first response to the business owners, because they're running a business, like, is it's actually not how it plays out in reality. Mm-hmm. You'll still experience the same number of failures. And so the economic motivation to increase the number doesn't hold water in terms of its justification. On the public health side, there's a big difference, I think, from public health people's concern about half 50,000 versus half a million CFUs.
Right, right. And, you know, those, maybe the number, if it's, you know, half a million penicillium versus 5,000 penicillium, right? Maybe it's not that bad, right? Because it's all penicillium. But think about how microorganisms fight each other, right? The more that are in there and the more diverse those communities, the more they are fighting each other. And that's what we care about. They use small molecules to kill their competitors. And those small molecules that they make also kill human cells. That's why mycotoxins are bad. So, you know, any more diverse communities or any higher numbers, you can very quickly assume that there will, the likelihood that there are more bad things for humans goes up.
And only the strong survive, right?
That's right.
So, if there's half a million folks fighting over, half a million bacteria fighting over mold, fighting over this little piece of cannabis real estate, the weaker ones, the ones who are less problematic for us, they're going to get got. But the stronger ones are going to survive, because that's how it works. And so you have this kind of like increasing risk profile that will occur as this total yeast and mold testing is. The other thing that I've heard regulators talk about is, because we don't have cGMP, this is the only number that gives us an indication of the overall health of the facility.
Right.
Right. Now, there's probably a lot of ways you could go about resolving that, but I think there's some, I think there's some logic to what I've heard regulators say about this, where I have very little authority if I like to do anything about the overall cleanliness of a facility. I mean, there are some rules, but they're regularly not followed. They're not really enforced. They're not what people are looking at, that they're not really, there's not a lot of oversight of the overall health and cleanliness of your facility. You were talking about in the pharma case where, like, if there's a single hair, they're doing like a massive analysis and they're like trying to get to the bottom of it. Like, there is nothing like that in cannabis. It's not a clean room environment. There's very little regulation oversight of the overall cleanliness of the facility. And so regulators will say this total yeast and mold, that's the only indicator that I have about whether a grow is or isn't clean. And I would assume there is some level of correlation to your generalized total yeast and mold scores and the overall cleanliness of a facility.
Yeah, absolutely, right? As much as a big question mark there is the sampling bias that we get, of course, but you know, absolutely it correlates with indoor, outdoor, clean facility, non-clean facility, right? PPEs. I haven't looked at that, but that would be super interesting. If I could correlate the PPE practices of cultivations with their total yeast and mold numbers, I bet that I could. You know, a lot of the micro tests, we can even predict the weather. And by that, I mean, when a hurricane rolls through Florida, I see a slight increase in the number of aspergillus fails 2 weeks later. So not only is it indicative of what's going on in the facilities, it's indicative of what's going on in those states that the facilities are in.
Yeah, of course. Right. Like, I mean, I'd be more concerned if these things didn't happen. Right. Like if these correlations didn't hold, these ones that make sense in theory didn't hold when you actually did the testing, I'd be more concerned. Right. I'd be even more concerned about sampling bias and things like that, because it turns out that when shit's wet, it should be moldier.
Right.
Like just, you know, logic. And so when things don't follow what like logical assumptions should be, it doesn't mean there's a problem, but it does say, hey, we might need to look more. So if you were like, no, man, hurricanes are not, everything's the same in Florida, I'd be like, I don't know, man, I'm in a Florida. It gets pretty moist down in Florida. It ain't Denver, that's for sure.
Power outages, right? Yeah, it's impactful for sure.
All right. So the other thing we touched on that I think is worth getting into a little bit is mycotoxins. And what does... I do want to talk about aspergillus. I guess we skipped over, I don't know if salmonella or E. coli are very interesting or exciting to talk about, is bringing up, you know, kind of, there's a lot of talk about aspergillus.
Sure.
How much of a, maybe the angle to take here, because I don't want to get into the, is it safe, how dangerous it is stuff. I'll let public health people opine on that stuff. But how much, like at what rate do you see aspergillus fails? Like, what does the testing result data tell you about aspergillus?
You know, aspergillus is certainly on cannabis. We see it on the plates. We can grow it. But when I look at the total pass-fail for aspergillus tests only in all of our states, it's well below 1%. So 99 point whatever, right? Call it 99.1, call it 99.5, somewhere in there, depending on the state, that percentage of products is passing. And so, you know, sometimes when I get on these calls, right, the aspergillus calls that you mentioned, or in other states, you know, I say, well, what is an acceptable rate of detection? Because 99.5 seems like it's not a problem to me. And I, you know, I get a different answer each time I ask the question, right? So if I query my data set, I would not, and I was, you know, brand new to the cannabis industry, and I ranked every single analyte in terms of the percentage time that I saw it, I would not come to the conclusion that aspergillus is a problem for the cannabis industry. I would definitely rank other things in that problem.
Right. And when you say not a problem, you're not talking about it's how safe or dangerous it is.
No.
You're talking about its frequency of appearance.
It's there or it's not there.
If it's there or it's not there. Is it like, how often are we detecting aspergillus? Now, again, sampling bias, but putting that aside, because we got to live in the world that we have, which is the data sets that exist. We are not finding aspergillus to be a problem. And so, but we hear about it. It's a very noisy issue, right? And so one of the things that you're not seeing, or that isn't adding up, essentially, in terms of what you're saying, is the level of noise and concern, the number of people complaining about aspergillus. There's a spicy piece of legislation in Colorado going on right now, and there's some folks who are like at war over aspergillus. And your response to them is, okay, but like over 99% of Colorado cannabis tests pass for not having aspergillus on them. Sampling bias aside, one way or another, it doesn't have it there. So is this as big of a problem as people are making it out to be?
Right.
Or is this a, you know, facility issue? Like, because I don't want to deny the people who are saying this is a problem for my business. I don't want to say they're wrong, right? Like, we don't live in their lives. We don't walk their shoes. Like, it may be a huge problem for their business. But it sounds to me that, like, maybe aspergillus is more of like a localized issue where there's a small number of businesses that are having significant aspergillus problems. And then once they identify what's going on, they get those things under control pretty quickly.
That's right.
But it is catastrophic in that moment. And when something is catastrophic in the moment, people get noisy. That's how politics work. And then all of a sudden, you kind of see this kind of like ebb and flow of aspergillus, you know, kind of people getting very nervous. And you mentioned the hurricane in Florida. All of a sudden, aspergillus numbers go up. And maybe that's some of the things, is that these environmental conditions, these individual facility conditions, aspergillus, maybe the lesson is aspergillus can be a major problem for you, even if it isn't a major problem for the industry writ large. And balancing those two things from a political perspective and a policy perspective can be very challenging.
Yeah.
Because we don't want to deny the person in crisis who's been like, hey, man, like, you're saying it's not a problem. 65 of my last 100 tests failed for aspergillus. I haven't heard that number. That number's crazy high. I'm making it up because it sounds outrageous. But that person is in crisis, right? That person is having a huge problem. It can also be true that 99.5% of the entire industry writ large passes and that it is not an industry problem, but that doesn't mean aspergillus isn't a huge problem for specific individuals and specific companies. And what we need to do is find a way to help those folks who are having the spikes, the kind of bubble problems, and help them with best practices get their stuff under control. What it doesn't mean is like aspergillus testing lacks merit entirely. Because that's not what the data, that's not what the public health people say. It's really gnarly. I'm not a public health person. Let's just say they're right for now. Let's say it is gnarly. And you're saying, yeah, it's gnarly, but it's not showing up a lot, which is good. That's what we want.
Right.
But how do we help the folks who are having a crisis? Because we wouldn't be hearing this much noise about it if there weren't folks in crisis.
Right? No, for sure. Right. And I think there's even a little more to that. Right. But, the license density of people who are having detections is definitely, it's not equally spread, right? And I think MED here in Colorado has said that they've seen the same thing, right? It's only a few clients who have all these repeat detections. It's not every client who has a small problem, right? The other thing about aspergillus is its presence-absence, right? So, you know, you have one CFU per gram and you fail, and people, that rubs people the wrong way, right? Like, one, are you serious? One, and now my product has failed. I could go test any pine tree on a mountain in Colorado and, you know, likely it would have aspergillus on it. So it's ubiquitous. How could I fail for something that's ubiquitous, right? You hear that argument a lot too. But all contaminants are like that, right? Go find me soil that doesn't have copper or lead in it. I'll wait here, right? Does that mean that copper and lead are not dangerous? Of course not. So there are, you know, some marketing problems, I think, that aspergillus has in general. But this is the point of testing. If something is gnarly, and we're assuming that this is gnarly, and it's not a problem for a lot of people, but it is a problem for a few people, shouldn't we detect it and help those few people solve the problem?
Yeah.
I would argue that we should. And who's good at helping people solve problems? Is it a legislator or is it a testing lab? Like, I know I could probably eliminate aspergillus from cultivations a lot faster than, a sentence in the 2025 regulations for cannabis.
Yeah. And I mean, that's the other part of this is people get very upset with the non-detect thing. I think one of the conversations that's been going on in Colorado, without getting too into our specific situation, is what should the number be? How do we determine the number that is defensible? And then what is the cost associated with determining the number? And this is a point you've brought up a bunch of times. It's like everyone's worried about their testing costs. If you tell me I need to quantify this, your test costs are going to go up. In significantly, not in an insignificant way. Your testing costs will go up significantly. That is a big deal. And so we have to ask ourselves, like, people get upset when they fail at one CFU. Fair. I can get that, and I can empathize, and I can feel that. Mm-hmm. How are people going to feel when you say everything's got to be quantified, and all of a sudden your testing costs go up 5x? And, you know, I think that there was some conversation about potentially forcing this type of quantification and number setting on the regulators. And I think we broke the record for the largest threatened fiscal note in the history of cannabis. The numbers I heard were astronomical. And I don't think it's going to move. I think things are going to change in that piece of legislation, so it's not worth getting too much into. But the point is that the quantification that sometimes the people who are getting upset about one CFU, like, just because their frustration is reasonable and grounded in something very reasonable, doesn't mean that the potential solutions are reasonable or viable. And in this case, the potential solutions would cost, would basically, is akin to replicating the FDA with inside the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, which I'm going to go out on a limb and say is outside the state of Colorado's current budgetary viability. So we've got to come up with other solutions here. And I think the first best line of defense, one, I think a little bit more testing on the front end, maybe a little bit less endpoint testing, rebalancing the distribution, not more tests, potentially even less tests, but throughout the supply chain would help a lot. Environmental testing would help a lot. And then the folks who are running into an Aspergillus problem, getting them the help they need, because it is a localized issue. It's kind of like an outbreak thing, yep. Right? Like, yep. when you get like every kid in a kindergarten class has like, what is it, like pink eye or whatever. You know, it's not that every kid in school has pink eye. It's a localized situation. So do you need to give every kid in school antibiotics or just the kids who have been, you know, at risk exposed?
That's right.
Are we good? Can we talk about other gross things or should we?
Let's pivot. But I think a good pivot point is this idea of, you know, one being bad, right? Because you've had a huge number of conversations on Aspergillus, I'm sure. So have I. Is one bad? Like, that's still a question that, like, you know.
Nobody has an answer to.
It's an opinion at best, right? And maybe you find some case studies in the literature saying one is bad. You know, maybe you don't, right? So.
But I think every other industry, how much would it cost to get to the answer of what number is bad?
Right, exactly. Like, and we do this in all other industries.
Millions and millions of dollars.
Is a pesticide good or bad, right, on an apple? Right. We know the answer to that because the FDA has done tox studies and they work backwards. Right. Well, this is how much of this X thing is bad, you know, in cells and in animals. And we work back and then we say, OK, this is how they apply it on a pesticide, on an apple, you know, 2 months before that apple is harvested. This is how much the pesticide degrades. You know, they work backwards and they figure it out and they say, all right, here is how much pesticide is good at this point in time. And this is how much is bad. Right. And pesticides in cannabis, Aspergillus in cannabis, we have none of that information. We cannot work backwards because it's been illegal the whole time.
And right? It's very, very costly to do it.
Right.
Right. Like,
and
it's,
so it literally takes like, you know, $1 million to submit a pesticide and get it approved from the EPA.
I mean, we were looking at, you're talking about tens of millions of dollars per analyte to do this for the entire testing program.
That's right.
You're looking at closer to like $500 million.
Yes.
The state of Colorado doesn't have an extra $500 million lying around. Like, it just doesn't. Like, right. When you get into numbers like that, the FDA is the only one who can do that math. So, all right, I mentioned mycotoxins before, but you brought up pesticides most recently. So let's go to pesticides because, man, pesticides in cannabis are like, that was an area of law I never wanted to learn about. And then I got to the Marijuana Enforcement Division and they were like, Jordan, go figure out pesticide regulation and how pesticides work. To which I said, OK, good. Let me go figure this out. Met this awesome guy, John Scott, the Colorado Department of Agriculture. Really, really sharp guy who kind of gave me a little schooling. And the one most important lesson that you need to know if you want to get into pesticide land is the label is God, right? In pesticide land, the label is God. And that's probably the first important thing you should know. And that's what we learned. And then I learned there are no pesticides that are approved for use on cannabis. And so we got into this whole, like, it's not, is it approved for use on cannabis? Is the label written in such a way that it would be a violation of the Pesticide Applicators Act to use it on cannabis? So it's not an approval. It doesn't say no, which in my household, when I want to like spend a bunch of money on going on vacation is all I'm really looking for. Right. It's not that my wife said no. It's just that she didn't say no. Can we go to this music festival? I don't know. Maybe I'll take that as a yes. So that's how we're dealing with pesticide, is the same way we budget for things in the Wellington household, is my wife didn't say no. So that's good enough.
For sure. And in the testing world for a pesticide, you can't go on, well, maybe it's good enough, right? I need to pick a level where I will say this is good and this is bad. And if I don't have public health people to tell me what that is, right, the FDA or the EPA, then how do we do it, right? I'm a testing lab. I don't have $500,000 either. I can't do these studies for the cannabis industry. So what's been done is they set the limits so low that effectively it is a pass-fail. It's a presence-absence test. The limits are, you know, anywhere from 10 to 70 parts per billion. And that's a, you know, really, really low level, right? One, everyone understands the drop of blood analogy, right? One drop of blood in an Olympic-sized swimming pool, that's one part per million. I'm talking about one drop of blood in 1,000 Olympic swimming pools, right? That's super low level. And it's set there based on the sensitivity of what is achievable in today's instrumentation. Meaning all the LC triple quads that labs are using, they can, on average, see it at around this level. That's now my pass-fail level. Anything above is a fail, anything below is a pass. It's not based on any sort of tox data at all. Toxicity goes 0% into that.
And I think part of the theory behind that, right or wrong, is that the things that we're testing for are stuff you're not supposed to be using on cannabis to begin with, right? At least, and I am maybe not as up on the current specific list of pesticides, but when we first created the list of prohibited pesticides and the testing list for Colorado, we didn't have a list of prohibited pesticides. We had a panel that we had established of pesticides that needed to be tested for. And then the Colorado Department of Agriculture has a list of pesticides that would not be a violation of the Pesticide Applicators Act to use. That doesn't mean they're approved to use on pesticide. Again, that's not what we're looking for. We're not looking for approval. We're just looking to say that it doesn't say no. In this case, it doesn't say no. And then stuff that is a no that we thought people might use on cannabis. We went and looked at pesticides that could be commonly used on cannabis and said, which ones are a no-no? And that is the list for testing. So the reason they set it so low is because you shouldn't be using it in the first place, right? Sure. So if there's any of it on there, it means you got a problem. Now, there's the reality of sometimes things get on stuff even if you didn't put it on there, but the reason that it's so low is not because they want to set the numbers low. It's because you shouldn't have been using it in the first place, so it should be zero. Yep. And then you get into the, okay, cool, but now we're in practical space.
Sure. And the implications of that are, you know, far-reaching, right? Because they are so low, I can pretty easily tell the difference between the number I would get if someone was to directly spray that pesticide on, or the number that I would typically get if some farmer one acre away sprayed the pesticide, which would be allowed on corn or wheat or, you know, peaches, whatever. I can tell the difference, right? Because if it's 15 versus 150, I know, you know, this has been directly applied or not, right? And so now, because it's set so low, there are a lot of implications to businesses, right? The other fascinating thing that the data tells us is, just like we were talking about in micro, right? There's a shift, and now it's not a bell curve. Now it's binary, right? It's a one or a zero, right? When Colorado was testing for, I think, 15, including isomers, was the original list.
Yeah, it was small.
We could see, you know, a certain fail rate. And when pesticide testing started, you know, we saw a rate. And then over time, as we continued testing, the rate of failures decreased to near zero, right? People learned what not to use. Same thing happened then. We rolled out a new list. So right now on the cannabis side, we test for 28 or 30, including isomers. And in Colorado, and same exact thing happened. All right, there are all these extra analytes. Oh, detection rate starts, you know, high. Now it's above 5%. Test a little longer, drop, you know, near zero for those 28 analytes. So what we see is, again and again, people are using those things until we start to look for them, and then they stop. And are they stopping using those things? Are they not using any pesticides, or are they just shifting to new pesticides that aren't on that list, right? It'll be interesting.
I think that's an important point, right? Because we're talking about two different things. There is the pesticides you are allowed to use. Those are things where it would not be a violation of the label to use on pesticides. And now we also, with hemp, do have pesticides that are approved for use on cannabis. Because if it's approved for hemp, it's approved for marijuana, because hemp and marijuana are not real. They're legal fictions. It's just a cannabis plant. Right. So those things you can use, but there are things that are okay to use on cannabis. And then there are things that are not okay to use on cannabis. That is completely separate. That is, that sits over the top of all of this. Then there's what we're testing for, right? And so when we went from, let's 14 or 15 to 30, we didn't make 15 new pesticides illegal to use. Those 15 pesticides were already illegal to use. They were not allowed to be used. We are now just testing more of them. And what you're saying is that the testing data, the evidence is showing that people are using pesticides that they shouldn't be using, but that we're not testing for. Exactly. That there is this space, and that the evidence shows that that people are not using the pesticides that we're testing for that they're not supposed to use. But there is some people, and 5% is not everybody, right? It's not everybody. A small percentage of people are using pesticides that they shouldn't be using, but that we're not testing for. And that when we start testing for more pesticides people shouldn't be using, we start catching people using pesticides they never should have been using in the first place. This is not something that was allowed and became disallowed. Something that was never allowed. Now we're just looking for it. There's a big difference between the two.
So, you know, and Colorado's shifting to 106 pesticides this summer, right? So I expect the same thing to happen again. So what's the implication if you are a state regulator and you need to determine the number of pesticides that you want people to look for in cannabis? What's the logical thing that you would do?
I mean, there's too many pesticides on the market to test for everything that you're not allowed to use. So, I mean, my first statement would be that your enforcement solution cannot be solely based upon test results, that you need to be out in the field, because it would be very hard to construct, and maybe you'll tell me I'm wrong, but my gut tells me that there would be more, that testing for every pesticide that you shouldn't be using may not be feasible both economically and structurally. It just maybe there's just too many of them out there. There's thousands and thousands of them that you could be theoretically shouldn't be using. And so if you're solely relying on testing to determine whether people are using pesticides that they should or shouldn't be using, you will not be able to get that answer solely through test results. That the only way that you need to supplement that with field inspections, where you are going into people's facilities and looking at the pesticides that they have there, or looking at what they're doing to determine if they have things on their licensed premises that they shouldn't be having. Because I don't know how, unless you think it's possible, my instinct tells me it's not, to just have panels that test, because pesticides are tested in panels, so people don't know. You know, it's like you test for a panel of them. But could we have panels that cover everything in the known universe, or am I right that that's not really possible?
There are thousands of pesticides, I think, market relevant. Like, if you tried to buy pesticides to put on your cannabis, you could probably buy a couple hundred. So, you know, the FDA has panels of about 400, you know, pesticide assays that are about, you know, 400, maybe 500 different analytes. And they don't quantitate, they just screen for all of them. So the answer is yes, we could get there. Now, does that solve the problem? Does either of those situations, you know, screening a high number of pesticides or doing a high number of field investigations, solve the problem that we just described, right? A detection leads to a shift in use. None of them do, right? But if you're tasked on eliminating a bad thing from a market, you got to do something.
Yeah. And I mean, like, a high number of field inspections are probably also impractical. Mm-hmm. Right. Like, the regulatory agencies aren't going to send someone to someone's grow once a week. Like, it's never going to happen. It's just not functionally possible. But, you know, a lot of what we see, because regulatory agencies and government agencies are trying to be good stewards of their limited resources, that they use testing programs to narrow their enforcement focus, right? That testing is one of the tools that they say, okay, we can't go to everybody all the time. How are we going to figure out who we're going to visit, who we're going to pay attention to? Testing results drive some of that focus. I think the limitations on pesticide is saying is, hey, this is an area where exclusive reliance on test results is maybe a little bit more difficult than in other areas, and that you need to get out into the field a little bit more, because people are choosing what they're using based upon the testing, not based upon the label. At least some people, a small number.
What we're talking about is 95% good actors, right? But let me bring it home a little bit. there is no good option for a regulator. Increasing the panel, great, I guess. Maybe it works. Doing more field investigations, great. You know, obviously there'll be positive impacts, but both have negatives. What if we shifted it back to a CGMP where the cultivation or the manufacturer had to set their own limits and set their own panel based on the actual risk for their products?
I mean, it changes
the conversation. It's the only pathway forward, right? Either the federal government says this is the panel and everyone puts their head down and says, you know, okay, or we start evaluating the real risk in our products.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's eventually where things will likely head. But at some point, you know, you kind of, we need a bridge to get us there. And I, not just on the policy side, like the industry needs a bridge. Like, you know, and this is something I've been talking about in Colorado for 5 years now, is it is not economically viable if Colorado wanted to shift to a CGMP environment. The industry cannot do that at once. They cannot do it overnight. It's going to take time. And then the question becomes, how do you phase in something like that, which is where we're stuck, essentially. Like there's some level of recognition by some people. I don't want to say it's universal at all, but there is recognition by a decent number of people that eventually CGMP is going to come in. What we haven't been able to even chip away at is, how do we transition from where we are today to where many of us expect that we will be in the future?
Sure.
And how we get there is very, very challenging, because you get out of the academic question of should we do this and into the how are we going to do this? And we are getting into the reality of people's jobs, right? And how they take care of their family.
Of course.
And like that starts to get really thorny. All right, we're at like the 90-minute mark, so we may be breaking some Weed Wonks time records, but this is fun. And I got to get you off. I've kept you almost to the absolute max of our time, which would be the first one. So the last two we had on our list were mycotoxins and solvents. Is there one of the two that you think is maybe a little bit more interesting and worth talking about? Do we need to talk about both?
Let's just talk about mycotoxins, because we've mentioned it, you know, the entire conversation. Solvents is what it is, right? And mycotoxins is a super interesting study in perceived risk versus real risk, right? Of course, these things have microorganisms. Of course, the microorganisms are going to be fighting each other. Of course, mycotoxins are there. This is so dumb. Like, of course they're there. And I look at my past fail rates for mycotoxins at all labs, 99.99999. I don't know how many nines there actually are, but there are a lot of samples pass. Like the number of mycotoxin fails we have, you know, nationwide is very, very small. And it's always because, oh, the hemp got left in the barn the whole summer, right? It's something that doesn't really apply, you know, to how we think about, you know, cannabis businesses today. So theoretically, can they be there? Yes. Do we see them there? No. So what's going on? Right? Like,
why?
I know microorganisms are there. I know that they're fighting each other, because they always do. Why are we not seeing them? Well, the reason is we're just looking at the wrong ones, right? Botec got it wrong when they, you know, ranked the top five most likely mycotoxins that, you know, cannabis organisms would produce. You know, we did a little study in Colorado where we took 100 failing microbial samples. They must have a high number of total yeast and mold, or they must have an Aspergillus positive detection. So 100 microbial fails in the state of Colorado, all flowers. And we extracted the mycotoxins doing kind of a normal alcohol extraction. And then we, instead of looking for five specific ones, we just went fishing. We said, we're going to look for all different types of mycotoxins using, you know, high resolution mass spec, which is not something that most cannabis testing labs have. And we looked for, you know, almost 300 different structures. And lo and behold, we saw no aflatoxins. We saw no ochratoxin. But we saw a lot of other ones, some of them in as many as 40% of samples. So 40 out of the 100. So we are just looking at the wrong mycotoxins. When I took that list of things that we detected and I looked how bad they were, they're a lot less dangerous than aflatoxins or ochratoxin A is. But, you know, this is a risk equation, right? So risk equals how bad something is versus how many times you see it, the frequency of detection, right? And we have a really interesting shift here, because the ones that I know are there now are there a lot more of the time, in some cases 40%, but they're a lot less dangerous for you, right? So, you know, I think absolutely there should be a shift in the analytes that we are required to test for. But the very next thing that we need to decide after we make that decision is, well, what is a toxic level? What's a bad level of these new things? And again, we're right back where we started. We have no idea.
Yeah, and what is and what are methods of consumption, and how do they impact that too, right? It's yep. I had a very interesting conversation with my doctor, because I almost always use a vaporizer. I very rarely smoke these days. Realities of getting older, I guess. And one of the things I noticed was I tend to get like very mild congestion more frequently. Not a lot, not like I'm getting sick all the time by any means, and some of that's just life in your 40s, I guess. But you know, one of the things I said to my doctor is, you know, as I've shifted trying to be more health conscious and not smoking, and now I'm vaporizing and I'm doing it at much lower temperatures, am I increasing my lung exposure to molds and things that could be on the cannabis because I'm not lighting it on fire anymore? And he's like, yeah. I'm like, so what's healthier? And he's like, don't smoke weed. And I'm like, all right, well, that option's off the table. That one's been off the table for a minute. But, you know, it's just kind of like, it's a very interesting thing, right? Where, it's just kind of like the irony of everything, right? Is one way or another, it's going to get you. So, you know, you move from smoking to vaping and you're like, yeah, well, less lung damage, less heat damage. You're not smoking, less carcinogens, all this great stuff. But because you're not heating it up so much, you're exposing yourself a little bit more to the mold content and things like that. And I think, you know, some of that's what's here, right? Is we're not finding the most dangerous of forms of mycotoxins, but we are finding ones that are dangerous. The question is at what quantity, and figuring that out. That's how a company like Botec basically did the best they could, did their back of the envelope calculations. And that's what's stuck, because we don't have the kind of data that we would need, you know, to kind of figure this out. And how you handle that is very complicated. And to get Colorado to switch what mycotoxins they're testing for, you know, the immediate question is, the first question is, what should we be testing for? Then you tell them. The next question is going to be like, okay, what are the levels of that? And your study doesn't answer that question. You can say, hey, we're looking for the wrong thing.
That's right.
And I think you're able to say that. And sounds like you have defensively said that. And they're like, cool, we're going to look for this other stuff now. How much do we need to pay attention to? And you're like, I don't know, man. That's a public yep. health. That's a pub.
Is that my job too? Or yeah, exactly.
I always like to quote Andrew Livingston here, is you got to find the right nerd, right? As Andrew once said a long time ago, I'm not that kind of nerd. And I always think that that's an important thing to note, is we got to find the right nerd. And right now, the public health nerds who really can give you an answer as to what, like, they don't even exist. They're like probably kids who are in college right now that eventually will have jobs that don't really even exist today mm-hmm. inside probably the FDA, doing analysis of what levels of different contaminants are actually dangerous on cannabis.
That's right.
So the job of figuring that out, like, we don't have an answer to that question. We don't even have a job description for the person who does, like, that is not a posted job somewhere that they're currently hiring for anywhere that I'm aware of. And I think the cost of it's not practical for any state on their own to do it. The cost associated with this is massive, and the states are, you know, struggling enough with their budgets and finances. It's going to have to be something inside the federal government one day that can resolve this.
And unfortunately, we're going to run into it again and again, right, as things shift, right? Like, you know, how many products with high concentrations of terpenes are actually bad? You know, polyaromatic hydrocarbons, one of the worst things about smoking cigarettes. You know, guess what? When you combust cannabis, you probably produce at least some, who knows how many, polyaromatic hydrocarbons. You know, heavy metals, we look at 4 heavy metals now. We started screening 21. Guess what? If you are more likely to fail for one of the original 4, you're more likely to have high levels of some of the other stuff in there, right? So you name the example, and there's a lot more that can be learned as the dynamic nature of cannabis testing and regulations changes. And at the end of every single one of those questions is, well, how much is bad?
Yeah. And what's unbelievable, and I think maybe the sum up of this entire conversation is we are light years ahead of where we were, right? When you and I first started doing this,
absolutely,
the level of understanding and knowledge that we have is exponentially greater. It's orders, it's huge. It's orders, massive orders of magnitude. But we are still very far from where we want to be. We're very far from having the type of knowledge that would allow us to make ideal decisions around some of this stuff. And, you know, it's frustrating for, I think, everybody involved in a lot of ways, but it's also interesting and fascinating, and what makes working in cannabis maybe a little bit more interesting than something where all these things have answers, right? Like the search for answers, the search for knowledge and improvement here is a little bit more interesting because it's new. And we just don't have that level of history that we would with, you know, apples was the example you used, You know, and so that's cool. So it is what it is. But what it does mean is that, Stephen, I will probably have to harass and bug you to come back on the Weed Wonks again, join us for more fun, nerdy talks. And you will probably get far more pestering phone calls than podcasts in the future from me and my friends over at the firm being like, what the hell does this mean? Like I said, I could take your expertise and figure out how to make policy around it, but I'm not going to pretend to catch up on what you've learned over the last 20 years. I will just happily grab some tacos with you and have a drink from time to time and enjoy it tremendously.
Yeah, that sounds like a great plan. And you know, there are a lot of pretty interesting questions that we're going to answer, or at least all the middle schoolers out there are going to answer in the next 15 years.
Yeah, all the kids in middle school right now that eventually 20 years from now become cannabis scientists when you and I are hopefully close to, if not fully retired and old and gray, we will let them figure that stuff out. And then you and I will get together over a drink and be like, oh, my God, they finally answered this question. We've been talking about it for 20 years. That's so cool. And it'll be lots of fun. And if I'm lucky, I'll be able to do that with you over many, many years to come. So thank you so much for your time today. This was an absolute blast. I really tremendously appreciate it. And can't thank you enough for joining us and for all your help always across all time.
Of course. Nice to see you. Thank you, Jordan.
Absolutely. All right. With that, stay nerdy, everybody.